Hello, dear friends. Carol Side here with an important message from my heart. I'm sorry to say that when the founders of the homeschool movement died, their messages actually died with them. We don't want that to happen with Homeschool Made Simple. To that end, we have recently become a nonprofit ministry and are working hard to ensure this simple, inexpensive, and enjoyable method of educating our children will continue for many generations to come. If you and your family have benefited from our ministry, would you consider partnering with us financially? Our board has told us that monthly commitments are extremely helpful because they allow us to plan for the year. But one-time gifts here at the end of the year are also very much appreciated. As you pray together daily as a family, would you pray that the Lord would bless and guide us as we look to the future? And please visit our website, homeschoolmadesimple.net/donate, to partner with us in this next chapter. We can't wait to see what the Lord has in store. Blessings.
Learning about the ancient world is an important part of a classical education. However, you might find yourself wondering, how could pagan Greco-Roman stories be relevant for 21st century Christians? That is the question we are answering in this week's episode as we seek to give our kids a rich, historically rooted education. You're listening to the Homeschool Made Simple podcast. This is a podcast to help you homeschool simply, inexpensively, and enjoyably. I'm Rachel Winchester, a fellow homeschool mom using this method with my own three kids. In this episode, I'm joined by author Nadia Williams to talk about her new book called Christians Reading Classics. Nadia helps us understand why we need to read these ancient classics and how to gradually wade into these waters if you're at all intimidated like I am. Listen in. Today, I'm excited to have a new friend, Nadia Williams, on the podcast to talk about her new book called Christians Reading Classics. So welcome to the podcast, Nadia.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what I think is very interesting is that in a world where we're just trying to get people to read, you're not only trying to get people to read, but you're saying, hey, let's read the classics. So talk to me about that. Why is this so important to you, on your heart?
Well, for me, it started as a professional academic journey. As a kid, I really liked mythology. So in high school, I took Latin, and that's kind of the gateway drug. So then the summer after my junior year, I was in high school in Virginia, and Virginia has this amazing Governor's Latin Academy that's paid for by the state, like gather all the nerds for a couple of weeks every summer. And we had like lectures from college professors and so on. Got a like crash course intro to Greek. It was phenomenal.
Wow.
And I realized like, oh, I could get a PhD in classics and like do this for a living. And so I declared my major in classics at UVA the day before my freshman year started. I think the Greek professor who was advising undergrads at the time, he was excited, but he was also kind of taken aback like, oh, okay. And so then I got a PhD in classics, and along the way, at age 30, I came to Christ. So like after getting a PhD, and then a lot of things kind of came together, and I realized like there's so much siloing in academia that theologians don't read enough classics, but also people in the pews don't read enough classics. And yet the classics, the original classics, are how people like C.S. Lewis came to understand what Christianity is. So for the original converts, reading the Greco-Roman classics was apologetics.
Yeah.
Like you don't think of reading Homer as apologetics, but it is. And so with this book, I'm kind of going back to those roots and telling these stories. Like, how can we as Christians read the original classics? Because it's difficult. Like, it's not the sort of stuff that you normally read.
Yes. Right. Yeah. In your introduction, you said Christians today feel that the literature of the ancient world is irrelevant for them as Christians. And I was thinking, I don't know that I would personally say they're irrelevant to me, but I'm so intimidated by them of like, you know, this is not contemporary. You know, for the Christians, the early Christians, it was more contemporary literature for them. So it's, for us, it's like, it just feels so kind of, wow, this is hard. I mean, I have read The Odyssey, you know, I'm one of those. I'm familiar a little bit with Augustine's writing, but it's intimidating. So I think even before it's irrelevant, it's kind of intimidating for a lot of modern readers, I would say. So how do you kind of overcome that, I guess? I feel like just reading the parts of your book that I've gotten to so far, I feel like you're an amazing teacher. And just like, I feel like you're right there on the bottom shelf with me. Like, it's okay that you don't know anything. So I really appreciate the tone that you wrote with. But yeah, what would you kind of say to those people who are like me, intimidated by the classics?
I get that. I was thinking about that. And so this book is really training wheels. Mm. You know, like if you've never ridden a bike, you see this structure on like these tiny little, like very thin wheels. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking like, you expect me to get on this and move along and not break my neck? Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And the same thing applies to reading something that's new and unfamiliar. So this is what it is. Like, yes, you have the scary bike. And guess what? People across a long period of time have managed to like ride a bike without breaking their neck. And in fact, a lot of people even say it's fun.
Yeah.
Imagine that. And so to like extend the analogy to reading the classics, like, yes, here, we're going to put some training wheels on this and get you to ride short distances and figure out like, why is this good for you? What is this doing for you as a reader? How is this stretching you in productive ways? And how does it connect to your faith? Because really, that's like the bottom line of this. Everything we read, everything we do is formational. Like, how is this forming us as disciples? And that's what I'm trying to get at here, that this is not intimidating. I mean, it kind of is when you first pick up, say, Homer. Mm-hmm. But how do you read it with Christian eyes, the eyes of believers, which connects you to believers across millennia, which is like a beautiful, beautiful thought. Mm-hmm. As believers, we don't think enough about our DNA that connects us to people 2,000 years ago. Like, this is incredible.
Yeah, yeah, that is really cool. And in talking to you, it's really interesting that your conversion really mirrors Lewis, who you talked about in your introduction. So maybe what were some of the as you came to Christ, what were some of the mythologies or the stories that then really helped you kind of see the faith? Because I think maybe for people who are just growing up in the church, you know, that's not how they come to faith, through learning the false stories and then seeing how true Christ is in comparison. You know, we're learning the truth and then comparing them to the mythology. So kind of, I guess that's an interesting reverse that's not necessarily happening for people who grow up in the church.
That's a good point, yeah. And I've had those conversations with my husband, who has been in church since he was 2 days old. Mm. I mean, like, he grew up in a Christian household. Like, he has no memories of a day when he didn't know about Christ.
Yeah.
And for me, it's not necessarily specific mythology. So for C.S. Lewis, Surprised by Joy is his memoir of this, like reading the classics as a kid, as an adult even, and then finally like realizing, oh, this is what it means. These are not just scary stories that are stressful and cause nightmares, which they did for him as a kid. These are true, but they're not fully true. Mm-hmm. They're pointing us to something greater. And that's the part that I can really relate to, that I was always fascinated with these stories, but their meaning, their full meaning was not clear to me until I came to Christ and realizing the beauty of God's promises in a world filled with forces that feel malevolent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. It's very good. Yeah, so for Homeschool Made Simple, we, in our seminars when we're teaching and helping families learn how to homeschool, we really emphasize Western civilization and like making sure that children really understand like ancient history, you know, not just American history.
Yeah.
But we do really encourage families to wait to introduce mythologies and false gods until they're fourth grade and older, just so that there's that developmental readiness where they can differentiate between the concrete and the abstract and
can understand that this is, you know, Zeus is not Jesus. And, you know, we're not trying mm-hmm. to get things mixed up and everything. But we definitely really want our kids as they're coming up to really understand what these mythologies and the ancient literature was.
Greek mythology was never meant to be examples of good life.
Mm.
Announcing more great resources from Crossway Books, our partner. 10 questions series, 10 questions about salvation, 30 devotions for kids, teens, and families by Champ Thornton, with a foreword by Paul David Tripp. And then another book in that series, 10 questions about pain and suffering by Beth Broom. These are great little books. I like how concrete the questions are. I like how thoughtful and careful the theology is. And I like the way in which it actually equips parents to disciple their kids and to answer some of the toughest questions that kids are so skilled at asking and that can sometimes catch us off guard. So pick up the books in the 10 question series wherever books are sold, or visit crossway.org/10questions, crossway.org/10questions, to learn how to get 30% off with a free Crossway Plus account. JJ Side here to talk again about our partner CTC Math. The founder, Pat Murray, is such a gifted math teacher, a dad of 10 himself. When I happen to be home and my kids are working through the material, I really enjoy hearing his voice on the teaching videos. They're short, they're concise, they're practical, they're helpful, they're fun. They get your kids quickly into the work, practicing what they've just learned. It's taken so many of the tears and the tension out of the doing of math here in the side house. And there's even a 50% discount for homeschool families. You can go to ctcmath.com to learn more.
In Christianity, we have a lot of examples of a good life. Mm-hmm. Like, and good books help us think about what does it mean to live a good life?
Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of the converse of, like, what does it look like when chaos is not under control and has no hope of being under any sort of control, or there's no redemption. Even the gods are living mm-hmm. by their own whims and fancies and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you're looking to Zeus for salvation, I've got bad news for you.
It's not going to work.
It's not going to work.
Yeah.
And these novels really convey that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it just makes God and Jesus, as revealed in the Bible, just all the more like shine brighter and be like, there is none besides you. And it helps us to see that more.
And I think the early Christians really saw that when they read pagan literature. Mm. That's an apologetic that we're missing when we're not reading those early pagan texts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, so how do you see these ancient texts that you reference throughout your book? How are these kind of forming the early Christians in a way that you see maybe we are missing out on, or that we're missing out on, I guess?
I think for a lot of people, especially if you grew up in church, the beauty of the gospel has kind of lost the shine because it's almost like for granted. It's like, well, you've been at church, like my husband, since you were 2 days old. Mm-hmm. You've heard it all. It's like, okay, fine. I've heard this before. But the whole point is, like, we need the gospel.
Yeah.
And the early Christians could really feel it. Like, we need the gospel. Mm-hmm. If this is what the world is messaging us, the gospel has an answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it probably gives greater insight to the culture that we're in, which is actually a pagan culture, just not necessarily the same ways that we look at other ancient or contemporary pagan cultures and we can identify, oh, why are you bowing down? Or you have these mythologies mm-hmm. about these particular, you know, gods. But then we're blind to the same sort of things that are in our culture because they're not necessarily shrines on the side of the road, or gods that we tell these stories about in the same ways. And so maybe what about that?
AI, I think, is a great example. So like the way technology right now is being put on a pedestal is the new pagan mythology that we're building. Like the conversations about designer embryos, just all of this. And like the whole idea of AI as superior intelligence, as Elon Musk has said before, that we are creating this superior intelligence, that like we, the scientists, can make better gods. And I think about this, like C.S. Lewis wrote about this in That Hideous Strength, foreseeing a lot of this decades earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating to see like our left to our own devices, we want to make ourselves our own gods, mm-hmm. which is very pagan.
Yeah. Yes. And that we in and of ourselves have the remedy, have salvation, which I think too, in order to be able to believe that, you have to neutralize sin in that mm-hmm. evil cannot be as evil as it truly is. And so you kind of have to bubble wrap it like, well, it's and mm-hmm. kind of soften the edges of wickedness and not use those kind of words about to describe things. But and so you don't need as much salvation because it's not that bad, or it's not actually bad. It's not actually wrong. But it, you know, but if things are actually wrong, if there is actually evil, if there is wickedness in our own hearts and all around us, then you start to have a way bigger problem than robots and AI and, you know, just we ourselves can solve. And then, you know, but if you neutralize all of those things, then you don't actually need a very comprehensive salvation. And then it just continues to spin and spin.
Yeah, I think about this with mythology, like that's the evil is all projected onto specific forces. You have monsters, you have evil gods who are attacking you. So all of that evil is concentrated there. It's never the hero's fault, or at least not mainly. So the idea of us ourselves having any blame is taken out of the picture. And that's a really attractive message in some ways. But on the other hand, then you look at what sort of salvation do you get then? It turns out that it's in your hands.
Maybe we could look at your book and just look at the different parts and maybe why those are so significant, why you chose to break it. So the first part is longing for eternity. What was kind of significant about that for you?
All of us, the human dream is to live forever, right? Mm. People have always historically been afraid of death. And the ancient epics are centered around this idea that, okay, we're all going to die, like physically, but what if you could live forever in glory? Just the idea of being glorified through these great epics that will keep being told and retold, sung for generations. And that's the idea behind the Homeric epics. All of those heroes are longing for kleos, everlasting glory. And it's a hint of a longing that God has planted in all of us. We do get to spend eternity with God. Like that's something that is beautiful and is such a stunning and difficult to understand part of the gospel. But it's fascinating to see people in antiquity before they knew Christ already feeling that longing. It just could never be perfectly fulfilled. And yet, in a way, it's true. Like, we're still reading Homer, even if we might complain about it sometimes. Like, we know the names of the heroes. Like, you know the name of Gilgamesh or Achilles or Odysseus precisely because those epics.
Yeah, and stories are still being made on those templates in a...
Exactly. You know,
that sort of idea. Yeah. Yeah. So then you talk about the formation of virtuous citizens.
Yeah, so that's trying to like put wheels on a realistic concept for all of us. At a most basic level, people have always known that virtuous citizens are better for the state than citizens who are not virtuous. Like, what sort of society do you want to live in? There's a reason that every society, whenever like laws are made, one of the first is do not murder. Right. Because, well, turns out you'd rather not, like no one would like to live in a society where murder and chaos and just complete anarchy are the rule of the land. And so, but it gets a lot deeper than that. Like, what does it mean to be virtuous? What does it mean to shape your nature? And so even though people in antiquity before Christ didn't really think about like, what does it mean to have a corrupt nature, sin nature? They still were thinking about like, how do you form citizens in the virtues? And the Athenians in particular, whether it's because we have more evidence about them or because they really did think about it more than others, we have really great information about how they tried to form their citizens. So democratic citizens need to be good citizens.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I had another conversation on another episode about where we were talking about AI specifically. So it's interesting that this came up with you as well, because I was not thinking about it at all in reading and looking at your book. But I feel like that is a huge part of this aspect, is that if our kids are just programmed, and this is kind of part of what came out of that other conversation, was just how really our civics and like our citizens are at stake, and our ability to be a society is at stake if people are not being formed into virtuous people. And if, you know, they're not being formed to be like fully alive, then it's going to have hugely detrimental effects on our society, basically.
Yeah, because we're being formed by something. Like, there's no, we're not empty shells. Like, everything we do, consume, and so on is forming us. And so the question is, how and for what?
Yeah, yeah. It's sobering, but it's also like, but we have tools that we can do these things, and we can be formed ourselves and our children, and create this counterculture that really, you know, I've read and I've heard multiple people talk about how the next revolution kind of happening around the table. And, you know, I think that the church being able to offer this rich culture that is vibrant and alive and virtuous really gives something for people to come into from outside. I mean, you can probably speak to that yourself as an adult, you know, convert. You can probably speak to that even more than I can. But I feel like that is just what, as I think about creating virtuous citizens, that's the sort of thing that comes to my mind, is just like this vibrancy of culture that then is so attractive that other people want to come into, because it's this like blazing fire and the people outside are cold and dark, you know, and they want to come gather around that.
Absolutely. And community is such a big aspect of it. Just the idea of gathering together as people, not devices.
Yeah. So then you go on to talk about the words of power and the power of words.
So much of ancient world revolves around rhetoric. Like, when we think about what were the key skills that every single ancient man, so those who participated in the work of citizenship, had, they were all great orators. And we don't train our kids in public speaking anymore, and we really should do more of that. But leaving all that aside, like, what exactly does it look like even to speak words of power? And what is this power of words? Because that's something we see throughout the New Testament as well. Like, all of those speeches, pay attention. Like, I would encourage people, when you're reading the New Testament especially, pay attention to all the instances where somebody gets up, gives a speech, and the crowd goes, wow.
Yeah, right.
Or in the case of Stephen's speech where they pick up stones. But so it doesn't always
still
turn out
powerful
well,
but response.
But it's still a powerful response. Yes. Like transformational speeches.
Right.
And so I look at that in pagan literature, just Greek and Roman examples of that, mostly Greek, but just the idea of oratory as this essential skill for citizenship. Knowing how to talk to people, knowing how to read the room. So I lean on Aristotle for that, especially, but not just, because we have speeches from antiquity. We can read speeches from the Athenian courtrooms, for instance. So we can see, like, what sort of arguments actually worked in a law court. And a lot of times it comes down to the virtues. The most powerful trope, if you will, is when somebody says, I'm a virtuous citizen. My opponent is not.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I just don't even know the depth of ancient literature that's even available. So for you to say that there's all these different types is so interesting to think about the different, you know, you could find your kind of niche within ancient literature to then be like obsessed or fascinated with one particular thing. I think of it as like just epics. You know, and it's like, well, I don't really think I would, I don't love epics, you know, but then these sort of things that it's like letters or speeches, that could be really interesting to read those kind of things.
Yeah. And I would say tragedy perhaps is some of the most relatable. So the genre of tragedy, because they're not super long, but they have a contained story. And each tragedy takes space in a time span from sun up to sundown. So you get like a single day in which the characters' lives are transformed. And it's really powerful and it's emotional. Mm-hmm. And it was made that way. The idea was make your audience weep. And it does. It's incredible. But yeah, like that's really my aim with the training wheels. To come mm-hmm. back to the bicycle analogy, the training wheels are on and you can explore and you can see and you can kind of understand, okay, here's how I might relate to that. Mm-hmm. Because people haven't changed much. Like we think of ourselves, here we are, modern people with our cell phones and like access to all sorts of technology. But who we are, like how God made us, guess what? God is still making people the same people, like with the same human nature as he did 2,500 years ago.
Mm, yeah, that's awesome. That's cool. And to for this to help us in our reading the Bible, to really be able to, you know, I think it's, a lot of us probably read our Bibles out of context, not really knowing like what the culture was when Jesus was standing up and teaching or what the culture was when the apostles were going around and giving those speeches that you were just talking about. So I think this will definitely also help us be better readers of the Bible as Christians as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, because all of those genres, I mean, these are men who knew their ancient literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even like in Acts when they're quoting certain things and I'm like, I don't know where that came from. So yeah, that's cool. Well, there's two more sections in the book, but heroes and role models and virtues and vices in the age of anxiety. And those bring us into some of the early Christians, correct?
Yes. So looking, for example, at Augustine's conversion narrative, which in some ways actually isn't that different from C.S. Lewis. Mm. Augustine knew his pagan literature.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Well, thank you so much for writing this book. I think it's going to be such a help to people like me and to our students who are coming up and learning about these things, you know, during high school and middle school and college. So thank you so much for writing this book. And where can people find you or connect with you if they want to learn more?
I'm on Substack, and that may be like the easiest aggregate since I post weekly updates.
Yeah, that's great. And look for your name. There?
Yes.
Okay, cool. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. So thanks for joining us on the podcast, Nadia. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Rachel. You're doing great work.
You've been listening to the Homeschool Made Simple podcast. If you like what you heard in this episode, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or share this episode with a friend. It means so much when you help us spread the message of Homeschool Made Simple with others. Thanks for joining us this week on the Homeschool Made Simple podcast. Remember, Jesus' commandments are not burdensome. What he calls you to do, he will enable you to do. Blessings.